Let's talk about some historical events today, starting first of all with events that occurred starting around 734 BC going into 733 BC. Remember that King Ahaz of Judah, who is not a nice guy, had refused the overtures of God to trust him because he was afraid of Rezin, the king of Damascus, and Pekah, the king of northern Israel, invading his land and taking him off the throne and replacing him. And so instead of trusting God, Ahaz decided to put his trust in Tiglath-Pileser III of the Assyrian Empire. So 2 Kings 16:7 tells us, Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come and rescue me from the hand of the king of Assyria and from the hand of the king of Israel who are attacking me. And Ahaz also took the silver and gold that was found in the house of He Who Is and in the treasures of the king's house and sent a present to the king of Assyria. So instead of trusting God, Ahaz puts his trust in a human king. But it's a human king that he feels he must bribe to save him. So he takes a bunch of gold and silver from the royal and from the temple treasuries and sends to him. Verse number 9 reports, the king of Assyria listened to him. That's where we need to go over to 2 Kings 15, where it says in verse 29, in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser III, I put the third in there because we know that's his number, king of Assyria came and captured Eon, Abel-Meth-Ma'akah, Yon-Oh, Kedesh, Hatzor, Gilead, and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and he carried the people captive to Assyria. So we're talking about the year 733 BC now, where Tiglath pushes down into northern Israel. He pushes all the way down to the Sea of Galilee and maybe even a little bit beyond into Gilead and other places. And he starts grabbing Israeli prisoners of war and slaves to take away with him. And this is going to break the kingdom of Pekah. And remember that God had told Ahaz, whether he wanted to know it or not, that within just a couple of years, the kings that he was afraid of, King Pekah of northern Israel and King Rezin of Damascus, both of those were going to be out of the picture. And so that is now in process while the little baby of Isaiah and the unnamed prophetess that he's recently married, that little baby is just starting to toddle around and maybe is getting a little supplemental food. Exactly as was predicted. These kings are not going to be a trouble for the southern kingdom of Judah any longer hereafter. I think this is probably a good place for us to go to Isaiah chapter 17. And realize that there was a prophecy on the books, out in the open, that Damascus and the whole area of northern Israel that was on the east side of the Sea of Galilee and down into Gilead and along the east coast of the Jordan Valley, all of that was going to be brought under the control of Tiglath very shortly here. So verse 1 of Isaiah chapter 17 says, "An oracle concerning Damascus. Behold, Damascus will cease to be a city and will become a heap of ruins." Now, there's some commentary debate as to whether or not this was ultimately fulfilled when the Assyrians swept through Damascus in 733 BC. We know that they tore stuff down because that was just typical procedure. So Damascus did end up being ruined. Damascus also quit being an independent city of the Syrian kingdom of Rezin, because Rezin is going to be dead shortly. Some people believe that that was not sufficient enough of a fulfillment for this passage, because very quickly Damascus was rebuilt and became prosperous, and eventually it did have periods of independence. Even to this day, it is a Syrian kingdom or a Syrian country, a capital of the Syrian country. So some people have been suggesting recently, and I do have to add my maybe to the mix here, that perhaps before Jesus comes back, before all the events of Revelation, the final 3.5 years problems before Jesus comes back, that sometime before any of that transpires, that Damascus is going to be destroyed as a city. And the suggestion has even been made that it might be blasted in some sort of nuclear event. I don't know for sure that that's what's going to happen, but I do see that maybe as a possible way that this passage could be fulfilled even more spectacularly than what has been suggested back in the time of Tiglath-Pileser III. The rest of the chapter, though, does describe events that follow Tiglath invading the Syrian kingdom and then pushing south from there. Verse 2, "The cities of Aroer are deserted. They will be for flocks which will lie down, and none will make them afraid." Aroer is farther down the western side, not the western, the eastern side of the Jordan Valley from Damascus, quite a bit. And so the Assyrians are going to push down that far. "The fortress will disappear from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria will be like the glory of the children of Israel, declares he who is over the armies." So the Syrians of Damascus and the Ephraimites, as in northern Israeli people, they are going to be taken away into exile. That's the prophecy, and that will take place. Verse 4, "In that day the glory of Jacob will be brought low, and the fat of his flesh will grow lean." When you have military events occurring all over the place, people lose supplies, and starvation sets in, and people that are on starvation rations get thin, thin, thin. And so that's the description here. "It shall be as when the reaper gathers standing grain, and his arm harvests the ears, as when one gleans the ears of grain in the Valley of Rephaim." Valley of Rephaim is south of the city of Jerusalem. It was a big grain production valley. And so what's being described here is the Assyrians are going to be like reapers coming in during harvest time, and they're going to take people. Verse 6, "Gleanings will be left in it, as when an olive tree is beaten, two or three berries in the top of the highest bough, four or five on the branches of the fruit tree, declares he who is the God of Israel." When it came time to harvest olives, you would put netting or material on the ground underneath the tree, and then you would take a big club and would just beat the branches really, really hard. and all of the ripe fruit would fall off the tree at that point. But not all the tree, or not all the fruit, would be fully ripe enough to do that. So when you were done gleaning that, or getting that tree harvested, you'd move on to the next tree. There'd always be stuff still on it. And that would belong to the poor, according to the Mosaic law. The point that Isaiah is making here is when the Assyrians come through, they are going to collect people, but not everybody. There will be people left behind in the land. In that day, verse 7 says, man will look to his maker, and his eye will look on the Holy One of Israel. He will not look to the altars, the work of his hands, and he will not look on what his own fingers have made, either the Asherim or the altars of incense. So the reminder is, your idols are not going to be able to save you. You're going to need to look to the real God. Verse 9, in that day their strong cities will be like the deserted places of the wooded heights and the hilltop, which they deserted because of the children of Israel, and there will be desolation. When you have the Assyrians deporting people right and left, and people that didn't get captured just ran away, the cities are totally emptied out. The cities are desolate. Nobody's taking care of the fields around the cities. So that's the description that Isaiah gives after the Assyrians have swept through. Verse 10, for you have forgotten the God of your salvation. You've not remembered the rock of your refuge. And therefore, though you plant pleasant plants and sow the vine branch of a stranger, though you make them grow on the day that you plant them and make them blossom in the morning that you sow, yet the harvest will flee away in a day of grief and incurable pain. Just a fancy way of saying you put all this effort in to the land, but you're going to be taken away from the land. You're going to be gone, and you won't be able to enjoy the fruit of your own work. Ah, the thunder of many people. They thunder like the thundering of the sea. Ah, the roar of nations. They roar like the roaring of mighty waters. The nations roar like the roaring of many waters, but he will rebuke them, and they will flee far away, chased like chaff on the mountain before the wind and whirling dust before the storm. So a description of the noise, the cacophony of the battles and of the invasion, and how some people might even try to resist, but the Assyrians are going to be like a whirlwind coming through and taking people away and chasing others out, away from their properties. At evening time, behold, terror, and before morning, they are no more. This is the portion of those who loot us and the lot of those who plunder us. And so it's all going to be over soon with the Assyrians coming down. And Damascus will be hit at the same time. And we actually have the fulfillment of that in the historical writing of 2 Kings 16. 2 Kings 16:9 says, the king of Assyria listened to him. This is again a reference to Ahaz, the king of Judah, who begged Tiglath-Pileser to save him from northern Israel and from the Damascus kingdom of Syria. And so the king of Assyria listened to him, actually took his tribute money. And the king of Assyria marched up against Damascus and took it, carrying its people captive to Kir, and he killed Rezin. So just as God prophesied, before Isaiah's little boy gets very old at all, Rezin is gone, and the kingdom of Damascus, Syria, is broken, because the king of Assyria has swept down into it. We also had another prophecy that the Syrians, this is from Amos, the Syrians would be taken away into exile up to a place called Kir, which interestingly enough is where their ancestors came from. So they're going to go back to their origin site as exiles from the country of Damascus, Syria. And so Rezin is now dead. And Pekah, the king of northern Israel, he will soon follow. But first, we want to see what happens at Damascus, because something very, very irritating occurs. 2 Kings 16:10. When King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, he saw the altar that was at Damascus. So once Damascus is broken by the Assyrian forces, King Ahaz goes up there to meet with his savior, and I'm using that in air quotes, Tiglath-Pileser, to thank him in person. And while he's there, he sees this magnificent worship altar at the capital city of the Syrians. King Ahaz sent to Uriah, the priest, a model of the altar and its pattern, exact in all its details. So he had this Damascus altar, which would have been to a pagan deity, something equivalent to Baal, actually. He has sketches made of it, and he has measurements made of it. And he sends all that information down to the high priest in Jerusalem. Verse 11, Uriah the priest built the altar. So he builds a duplicate altar in accordance with all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Uriah the priest made it before King Ahaz arrived from Damascus. So that's what the king wanted. He believed that this was a beautiful altar. It was a magnificent altar, and he wanted one just like it in his temple. Now, he's thinking of the temple at Jerusalem as his personal property. And so the high priest cooperates in that, which tells you that he's not a good guy either. Verse 12, when the king came from Damascus, the king viewed the altar. And then the king drew near to the altar and went up to it, and burned his burnt offering and his grain offering and poured his drink offering and threw the blood of his peace offering on the altar. So now he's acting as if he's his own priest. This is part of his rebellion against God. And the bronze altar, verse 14, the bronze altar that was before He Who Is, he removed from the front of the house, from the place between his altar and the house of He Who Is, and put it on the north side of his altar. So there was this great bronze altar that David designed by the Holy Spirit's leading, which Solomon built and put out in the front of the great shrine building of the temple of the Lord. When Uriah built this second altar for King Ahaz, he built it farther east. When Ahaz first used his new altar, he didn't like the fact that the bronze altar of Solomon was between him and the front of the temple building. So he simply said, I want that altar, the original one, I want it just all dismantled and taken off to the north of my altar so that there's nothing between me and the temple building, the front building or the front porch of the shrine building. And then, verse 15, King Ahaz commanded Uriah the priest, saying, on the great altar burn the morning burnt offering and the evening grain offering, and the king's burnt offering and his grain offering with the burnt offering of all the people of the land and their grain offering and their drink offering. Throw on it all the blood of the burnt offering and all the blood of the sacrifice, but the bronze altar shall be for me to inquire by. So he says, I want this brand new altar that I put up the nice looking one, the brand new one. I want it to be used for everything now. But I'll use the old one. I'll use that for my own little private ceremonies because I want to be able to talk to God from time to time. Now, this is all insane. We just got to describe it in that fashion. The man is a reprobate. He is not just simply a backslider. He is a rebeller against God. And yet he is treating the temple of the Lord as his own personal property to do with as he wishes. And the high priest is letting him get away with it. Verse 16, Uriah the priest did all this as King Ahaz commanded. King Ahaz cut off the frames of the stands and removed the basins from them. That's the portable water tanks that are all around the temple building so that the priests can do their cleaning work of the sacrifices that they're preparing around the different sides of the temple. So he just dismantles all that. He took down the sea, that's the great big water tank, from off the bronze oxen that were under it, and he put it on a stone pedestal. So between the sacrifice altar that he's put up and the front door of the temple building, there was also the big water tank. And it was seated up on the top of 12 bulls. This is all part of the original design that Solomon put together. So he has the bulls scrapped. And he has the water tank lowered and just simply put on stones. So he's taking all these different things apart. Why? He's doing all this so he can send the material to Tiglath-Pileser. That's why. The covered way for the Sabbath that had been built inside the house and the outer entrance for the king, he caused to go around the house of He Who Is because of the king of Assyria. Again, sounds like as if he's dismantling things originally built as part of the worship complex to connect the king's palace area to the worship area of the temple. He has all that material taken down and evidently sent off to the king of Assyria to pay debts. And then we need to go back and talk about the northern kingdom of Israel and how things were resolved up there. So first, 2 Kings 15, we had just read verse 29. Let's read 30 now. Then Hoshea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and struck him down and put him to death and reigned in his place in the 20th year of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. So Pekah, during the middle of the Assyrian invasion, apparently escapes out of the hands of the king of Assyria. But Hoshea, as we'll discover historically, makes a deal with the Assyrian king. If you'll let me be the new king, I will track down and kill Pekah myself. And apparently Tiglath-Pileser III agrees with that. And Hoshea assassinates Pekah and becomes the next king of the northern kingdom of Israel. And so the northern kingdom is now subservient to Assyria. Damascus is subservient to Assyria, and Judah is subservient to Assyria. So the whole lower Middle East is now looking to Tiglath-Pileser as their leader. Verse 31 finishes up. Now, the rest of the acts of Pekah and all that he did, behold, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. And then we need to finish up this historical account in 2 Kings 17. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, the son of Elah began to reign in Samaria over Israel, and he reigned 9 years. And he did what was evil in the sight of He Who Is, not as the kings of Israel who were before him. So apparently, Hoshea is bad, but he's not as bad as some of those kings of northern Israel that came before him. So the whole Middle East now is starting to fall into the Assyrian shadow, Tiglath-Pileser's leadership. Somewhere around this time, we have another prophet that starts prophesying. And his name is Micah. And so find the book of Micah. You can use your table of contents to discover exactly where it's at in your particular Bible. And this is what the introduction to that book tells us. The word of He Who Is that came to Micah of Morosheth. Morosheth is located in the hill country between Jerusalem and Philistia. So he is Judean. And so all this happened in the days of Jotham. Remember, Jotham was the good king who came to power after his father Uzziah got leprosy. And then when his father died, he reigned for a while. But apparently he was shoved off to the side by the next guy on this list, Ahaz, that we've been looking at, who is a rotten king. So Micah prophesies during those two kingdoms and also one other guy that we have not yet met, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. So we're going to go through the book of Micah and see what he lays out prophetically for this time period where the Assyrians are coming to the land as part of God's judgment against the sins of the Middle East.